Accession number 10613, rule 13.
Charles Burden Taylor, Reel 13. And we were talking about your time for about a year in the Chieti POW, Italian POW camp. You mentioned just briefly that you wrote letters. What contacts did you have with home and the letters front?
Yes, we were, I think it was about one a week, we were given really what it amounted to, rather like what today are called what air letter cards, I think. So that... perhaps not quite as big, but it was enough to, if they got through, anyway, to let people know that you're still alive. You always, obviously, knew that you'd be subject to censorship, and so you just really wrote commonplace things about what was going on, and really just reassuring people by getting a letter away. I don't think anyone refused a letter. I think that they would all send them, and in which case would maintain their links with the families.
And the letters back?
Letters back, yes. I found mine... were not all that... I didn't get all my letters, I know that, but I don't think I was unique in that occasion. And I certainly got very, very few of my cigarette parcels came through. Not enough. And but, of course, there was always the swap market, because the question of food... food had a value... And Red Cross parcel stuff, particularly. I don't think there's any other swapping of food. But odd things were worth so many cigarettes. It was, in fact, the cigarette was the equivalent of a stock market, I think, or stock market pricing, anyway.
What did getting back to the letters, what kind of things would they write to you? And were the letters very important to you, or to maintain morale?
Oh yes, yeah. No, I think that it was a link with home. I think that's the main thing. Because I don't think, I keep emphasizing the question of freedom. No matter how busy you may be in the camp, and I think the time at Chieti went, as far as I was concerned, very, very quickly. But physically and mentally I was keeping fit, and that took time. But I think that deep down one wanted that link with home.
The internal market, the cigarette stock exchange, which you raised there, who organised that? I mean, somebody...
Oh, just somebody. It was, mind you, it was official, shall we say. It was known to the senior British officer. As far as organising the swap shop, if you like, on cigarettes, and that you could hand something in, and if somebody was buying, then you could get something out. Other than that, then, of course, you just wandered round the camp, and you found people who, what can you say, very much liked something, perhaps that you didn't like. And you'd say, right, you can have all mine, and whatever the market rate is in cigarettes, I'll be glad to have.
Was there any actual profiteering? I mean, not with money, but was there anybody who sort of deliberately tried to make a profit, so to speak?
not in a nasty way. I think that might be... But one fellow who... he'd be nameless anyway, but... he used to really, perhaps instead of playing games or studying or something like that, one of his great things was to start out with, shall we say, a small tin of tinned cheese and come back with his tin of cheese again and perhaps a tin of condensed milk and a tin of bully or something like that when we had these things, because he was a very good bargainer and he used to spend his time going round the camp, particularly after a Red Cross issue. And he was certainly making from his whatever he started off with. He'd come back with about three times as much. But that was just straight bargaining, and that was his little forte. Nobody ever did anything, in my humble opinion, that I can come across underhand.
Besides the Geneva Convention things, made certain arrangements about pay and things like that.
Yeah.
Did you know anything of that, or did you get an allowance?
Yes, we got... shall we say, we were allowed to draw It was always camp money. You didn't literally get lira, and you didn't get Deutschmarks in Germany. But you had camp money and a very limited variety of things to purchase.
Where did you purchase these from?
Well, we were allowed in Chieti, the Italians would allow certain, it seemed to be from memory, rations of, shall we say, old pots and pans and mugs and that sort of thing, which we could buy. And that is on camp money again. But it was so limited, it's almost hardly worth really mentioning.
Was this later on, was this deducted from your...
From one's pay in UK, yeah. In fact, that's one of the things which there's been a certain amount of controversy since the war, as you've probably heard about this, that I think probably the rate of exchange or the amount that was deducted was basically wrong. I think I'm right in saying that somewhere along the line the detaining power was going to pay it all back. But I think they were rather thinking of the termination of war rather like the First War, as opposed to the last, when so much destruction and so much administration was destroyed. I don't think they'd get round to that. I think the government, our government, mind you, I think are very remiss, particularly with the Far Eastern people.
Did you feel... you obviously appreciate the overall case, but did you feel personally done?
Not...
then or now? Just about this paper.
Sorry. Well, I think that it only cropped up after the war. I think as a principle, yes, but the amount is not great. On the other hand, its purchasing power at the time in England was certainly great. But the limited use, the best time, I think, was the next camp I went to in Bologna, where we were allowed to buy a heck of a lot of fruit.
I'll come to that then.
Yeah.
Okay, the other thing is, we mentioned letters. Did you have any other source? Did you have any sources of information as to what was going out on in the outside world,
yeah,
outside the camp?
Yes,
if
well,
so, where did it come from?
We had newspapers were allowed in, and from memory, I think that was rather intermittent. But
which newspapers? British?
No, Italian. Oh, yes. Il Maggiore or something, I can't remember. But these were rather limited anyway, but I think one of the extremely good afternoon sessions which we had, or afternoon or maybe Sunday mornings, but there was a Major Lett who used to study the newspaper reports, and when strategic withdrawals to previously prepared positions were mentioned, that mentioned somebody was hell-bent going in the wrong direction. And he really used to do a very good appreciation from our limited knowledge of what was going on. And also, if anyone had anything that they had got through the censor, I believe that they used to feed things into him. And, of course, any new arrival that came in would be talked to find out what the up-to-date situation and what, if you like, what the morale was like and so on and so forth. But Let's Diaries, that's what it was called, every week.
Did you have any contacts with civilian Italians?
No. None whatsoever.
Not on your walks?
No. We were virtually surrounded by these little fellows, for the want of a more polite name.
And the other thing is, you mentioned that there were some American troops, or American officers
yep.
there. Well, how did you get on with them? Were they segregated from you? Or
no, they were just in one of the bungalows. There was, if you like, the American bungalow, and they would be about 120 strong. And they were a noisy lot, that for starters. They brought to us softball in lieu of baseball, which to them is a very noisy game because a lot of the tactics are on the basis of intimidation, if you like, by crowd control. But it was quite an experience to hearing them playing and barracking and so on. But they were in the next bungalow to myself. And they're an interesting lot. We did have an interesting weekly talk. We called it Keyete Triangle, the triangle being Keyete itself, New York and London. And an American and one of the British officers would talk on a subject, whether it be education in their own country or motoring in their own country, and give a short talk and have questions, which is quite interesting to make certain comparisons between their lives and our lives.
And so that was a sort of debated thing. Well, how did you get on generally within the camp? Between off, I mean, was there any pressure?
Not just
with the Americans. I mean, overall between the officers, did the sort of enforced captivity lead to any tension between people?
Not really. No, I think the nearest one might say, and it might be a mark of weakness, but you certainly found that people got slightly irritable when the cigarettes were short, and cigarettes. Really came in either individual parcels to individual recipients, or officially we were supposed to get 50 per Red Cross parcel, which should have been 50 a week. Well, that would be enough to keep anyone going. But if we didn't get the Red Cross parcels, then more than likely the cigarette parcels would also be a bit short. And, you know, you might get this sort of occasion if you happen to brush against somebody accidentally, who was normally as quiet as a mouse. If the cigarettes were short, he might turn round and say, "Who the hell are you pushing?" That's not as bad as that. But you certainly found people were on edge when the cigarettes were down.
And yourself too, I presume?
I think so. I think I don't remember bouncing anyone or anything like that. But I think one weakened. You know, one's will was slightly...
Why were cigarettes so important to you? I mean...
Well, ask anyone who, when you say you ought to stop smoking, and they say, "Oh, I can't." I have, as it happened. I haven't smoked for 10 years. But I think at that time I would have found it very... Well, it was enforced upon me. I should really have stopped then. That might have been a damn good idea, to have stopped smoking. I don't know. I think once you started smoking...
I presume it wasn't seen as a health risk then, either.
No, nothing like that, no. On the contrary, what we used to do, when you had a shortage of cigarettes, then you might lit one cigarette, you know, smoke it, half a dozen puffs, put it out, and wait until later in the day and have another half a dozen puffs, or something like that. And then when you got right down to the last half inch, you put that into a box to keep it. And then if you had two of those, you could break them and make what we call them greyhounds, a thin thing which wasn't much thicker than a thick pencil lead, and was probably made of, book paper. So that was pretty tough, and I think if anything was going to do your lungs a lot of harm, it would be smoking paper. Well, at one time we smoked dried out tea, and if you want really an obnoxious smell, smoke dried tea. Horrible.
What about, we've talked a lot about various aspects of camp life. What about efforts to escape or internal unofficial organisation, not the senior British officer and so on, but the escape or clandestine organisation within the camp? Were you aware of it at the time? It sounds like you were busy on other things, or did it exist?
The very little... In fact, I might say that I heard more after we'd left Keyete than I heard, you know, at the time. There's nothing in my own bungalow, and I don't know whether one was feeling that, you know, the war wasn't going to be all that... I don't know what my feelings were at that time. I was busy, and I think the days went by, and I don't recall any escapees in my bungalow. I don't recall any of the Americans escaping, but I do know that there was certainly one tunnel going on the other side, away from our side. So, and of course, really, it shouldn't be talked about anyway. because you never know when you're going to be bugged or whatever. So I heard nothing of, shall we say, the normal things like the escape committees and so on, which one heard about subsequently.
So it did exist, but they didn't broadcast, they didn't need you, so they didn't tell you.
I think that's a fair way of putting it, yeah.
Well, your own feelings were, you didn't feel, you were sort of feeling your way there. Why weren't you keen to try and escape at the time? I mean, what?
I think I've got to be fair and say that I don't remember it seriously crossing my mind. I think that I've got to say that, which is quite wrong, because your first job is to escape, you know, as a prisoner of war. That's different on the way.
Had you been told that before? Because you said you were briefed.
No, but I mean, one knows that. I think that's just the sort of thing that if you are taken, but it was never, you're quite right, it was never sort of drummed into us.
Did you, you mentioned that there was this these methods of introducing silk maps and such like.
Yeah.
You didn't know any of that while...
No.
And were you aware of it at all?
Not at that time. Not at that time.
No. That was Germany.
Yep.
Just covering some points to close, really, on KAT. You mentioned that there are about 1,000 officers and 200 other ranks. Where were the other... What was their role, the 200 other ranks, and where were they billeted within the camp?
Well, they were billeted... They, like us, had their own camp, but they were on our side of the wire. But basically, they were there to carry out administrative jobs, sweeping, cleaning, dusting. We had to look after ourselves, no question of, you know, sort of having the old-fashioned batman or anything like that. But that was basically their role. They also worked in the cookhouse, and those sort of jobs, really.
But you didn't... They were separate from you. You didn't mingle with them.
Oh, yes, no. I mean, they were in the same... if you can imagine, all these bungalows were surrounded by wall and barbed wire, and we were, shall we say, exercising in the evening. We were all walking up and down in the same area.
Would the differentials of rank be maintained, or would you chat to them?
Yes.
Was there anything else that you remember about your time at KAT?
Not really, but one thing does come to mind, and that is that they had a tannoy system throughout the camp, which they put over announcements and odd bits of music and so on. And they used to tell us to get inside when they wanted us off the campus, so to speak, and indoors for security purposes. And we said, well, look, instead of telling us over the tannoy, could we have Lilymar Lane? Which rather surprised them, because, as you know, it's very much the Africa Corps song, but it was also Eight Armies song, as far as we were concerned. Anyway, they played it, and other than that, I don't think there's anything really, anything of special interest.
Now, you were moved after about a year at KAT, which puts it sort of 42, 43, we're not quite sure of the dates. What was your first inclination that you were going to be moved? Did you know before the day they actually came to move you? Were you warned?
Oh, yes, yep. And I don't know, I think probably about 40 of us were moved, and we were just being moved up to Bologna, and there was no reason given, and I couldn't find out any reason, and...
So the KAT carried on?
And so that was just one of those things. Okay, they're moving, I think it was about 40 of us, and off we went, and that was it.
How were you moved?
Train.
Any thoughts of escape on the train? Did you see
not on
an
that one? No, that I don't recall. No, I don't recall even thinking about it. I think at that moment one must have had thoughts, because the next move we certainly did have thoughts, because that was going to be a trip to Germany. But I can't remember any conscious thoughts at that time. It was a question of, I suppose, being moved. It was something different. It was something that occurred, upset the routine, if you like. So that was that, and something we just accepted that as a fait accompli.
But had you picked up any personal possessions by this time?
No.
When you moved, what would you move with? What would you have with you? Just your uniform?
Basically what you stood up in. Odd bits of extra clothing that you had from, say, extra clothing from the Red Cross. and odd stuff that you'd have socks or pullover from one's next of kin parcel.
What
and
about
food.
What about things like mugs and, you know, you said you could possibly buy the odd mug and plate. Do you sort of have that?
No, I don't. Actually, I'm not too sure if I said mugs, I perhaps shouldn't have done, because we really, in the main, used the tin, a round biscuit tin was roughly a pint, and you could tart those up, polish them up, put them on a, fix a handle, and they were quite useful. But other than that, it was really just what you stood up in, spare clothing, towel, toothbrush, the usual thing, and whatever you had in the nature of Red Cross food.
What happened when you arrived at Ballonga? It was the POW camp, presumably.
Yeah. We had... I may say, just to get it in its right perspective, I think when it was at Kieti that we were allowed to buy small suitcases, rather these plastic, well, not plastic, but these sort of pressed fibre type things. And the thing there was to... but by this time, through envelopes, I'd received photographs of family, which I then had a daughter, which I hadn't had when I left the UK. And whenever we left a camp, you were searched, and your kit was searched. And, of course, invariably, as far as the Italian camp was concerned, any photographs of kiddies or loved ones or whatever, you always put them near the top, because they're a shoppy lot. And you, in many cases, find that you've got a very cursory search, because they spent too much time having a look at the family and saying the bambini was, you know, so sweet or whatever. But other than that, we were searched when we went out of Kieti, we were searched when we went to Bologna, and we settled in. It was very much a similar type of camp. Same shape and size of bungalows, high wall, and so on.
Were there any differences that you could comment, you know, because there's no point in going through it again.
No, absolutely. It was really going, we could have gone out of the Kieti door, come back in the Kieti door, and say, oh, we've moved to Bologna.
So how did you settle in easily then?
No problem. But I think one other thing about life in captivity is that you develop a tolerance. In fact, you have to, if you're short of things. If you're going to be short of food, short of space, short of heat, short of this, that and the other, you can very easily become short of temper. But you've got to learn to live with your other fellow PW and keep on a nice even keel footing. So in a move like this, you moved and that was it.
So what was the next thing to happen then? How long were you at Ballonga?
That was just a few months. Exact time, I don't think I could say. But really the next thing was that the army was coming up Italy and getting closer. And we were told that one or two plans had been made. There were certain entrances round the camp, which was different from Kieti. That was a difference. The odd door in a corner, that sort of thing. But, again, behind wire. But the plans were made that a sort of plan A, plan B, plan C, on the basis of when the army was getting close, or at a given point, we'd just be told what was going to happen. And there are certain things, for instance, going to the hills and joining up with partisans, possibly going south to try and meet up with the advancing 8th Army. And that was that. We heard about that. The next thing was that the Badoglio surrender took place. In other words, the Italians were out of the war, and whoopee, 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 and there were all sorts of rumours going round that we were going to be taken to Rimini on the east coast, and the Royal Navy would take us off. The rumour was rife in that direction. I must confess that I wasn't being clever, but I just personally felt that until I got my 2 feet over the cliffs of Dover, I wouldn't accept it. In the event, apparently, the Italian commandant, I believe he disappeared with a few million lira, but apart from that, we are told the Germans He told us that he was going to tell the Germans, if they inquired, that we were a hospital and had to be left alone. And I'm told that in the event he told them, A, we were officers, and B, that we were armed, which was about the most diabolical thing he could have told them, really. And
did the guards actually go at any one stage?
I don't recall that. I don't recall anything. I think in a way they must have gone, because from what subsequently happened, in the middle of the night, and mind, we were ready for this, we were ready to move at the drop of a hat, and in the middle of the night we were told that Plan A, or whatever it was, and we all got up and went off in a certain direction, shall we say, to the right-hand end of the camp, which was away from the administrative blocks, the Italian blocks. And I can recall seeing in the security lights that they had, Jerry's coming into the camp, and I don't know if you know it, but when you've got a section with a light automatic and some riflemen, then you leapfrog. It's what is termed fire and movement. But thank God they didn't fire. But they did, they went through that motion towards our side of the camp. But anyway, we doubled away to the right-hand end of the camp, if you like, towards one of the doors. The wire had been cleared, so I think the Italian guards would have gone by that time. And the next thing we heard, of course, was firing outside the camp. And the Germans had put fixed lines, which, in other words, a machine gun is mounted. I think you know what that means anyway. During the day, sometime. And, of course, since ever anybody went outside, they opened up. And one officer was killed. And, of course, then people started coming back into the camp. So that was the end of that particular operation. And the camp was taken over. And we just waited to see what was going to happen to us. A certain number of people did get out. And some were extremely lucky. From the point of view of, shall we say, getting away from any sort of fire and so on, and onto trains. And I believe one couple got all the way down to sort of mid-southern Italy, got off a train, hid up, and just waited for the army coming through. Some others, I think, went to the hills, or got to the hills, and not mixed up with the partisans. But the bulk were back in their bungalows.
So, I don't quite understand why, before the Germans came in, why they, if the guards had gone, why there was no effort to leave before then?
This will go back to, you asked me about, really, the sort of duties of a senior British officer. He is there to command. And if we didn't have that, then all sorts of horrible things could have happened. Because if you've got 1,200 individuals, all with their own ideas of what should happen, you can just get chaos.
So the senior British officer had said that remains put until...
We remain put until such and such. When this... How he got to know that the Germans were coming in, I don't know. But word came round, Plan X, whatever it was, which meant up with your bags, out through the gate, this door, and then the firing started. And I should imagine those people who'd got beyond the firing, because a lot were rounded up and brought it back in later, they would go off. But by the time my sort of group of people got down to that door, people were coming back this way, and it sounded very unhealthy to go through that door in that direction.